music session number 11486, reel 8.
Schools, I suppose they started with teachers. They sorted them out very carefully, and I think the things that were taught to begin with were couldn't be faulted in any way politically. No political overtones were at all. Whether people who worked for town authorities had any form of course for learning how to be better Democrats, I don't know. But then I suppose we'd had a town administration, a borough administration anyway, and I don't think actually it was that much changed, except that one after a year or so, they had actually local elections. See, by that time I was 20, but I'd never voted. There hadn't been elections. And the elections that had gone before FAS, I don't think there had been any elections since the beginning of the war, but I really don't know because I was not old enough and they were always a foregone conclusion anyway. We had elections, and I suppose the way Germany was reconstructed was in itself a lesson in democracy. But I can't say I can recall any particular course. We had a lot of speakers come and talk, famous people. Karl Barth from Switzerland came. And after a while, the parties were allowed to form. It was a very slow process. The permission for a party to form for a trades union. Quite interesting that, actually. As you may know, trades unions weren't allowed. There was a sort of National Socialist Workers' Association, which was not a trades union. And the old trades unionists had a pretty tough time, and partially they'd been demoted and been in a camp. And one of them, Herr Jochem, came and stirred up things, saying he wanted a trade union, in the proper spirit, really, but it created a bit of a stir in the works. And he wanted workers to have a say quite early on. And military government actually didn't like that because they didn't want a stir to happen. They didn't want people to stand up for their rights, as it were, then. So Herr Jochem was brought before the officer I worked for, and it was all talked out, and I interpreted, by which time I could speak English quite well. And I interpreted and I did it in a quite conciliatory way, and it was all turned out to be very pleasant and a very smooth meeting. And he had been threatened with being put into prison, and he wasn't. He went back to on. And it's rather funny, later on in life, and my father had to do with him. He was, of course, later on, he became something on high up on the Works Council. He always remembered me. Now, of course, at that time, he was workers' representative, and my father was management, and my father always got on very well with him because he had fond memories of me doing a nice interpreting job at Jochem, that's the trade unions. But it all started very slowly. And permission for papers for newspaper to be printed, and I remember the going to a very early meeting of the CDU, which father of a very close friend of mine was a founder member, and sort of going to actually a party meeting, which I had obviously never done before. So it was a slow, very thorough beginning, I think, with a good deal of, well, help and pressure, as it were, from the military government, which in this case was British.
This is going off the subject a little, but it's something I meant to have asked you earlier. The Allied policy of unconditional surrender, did that make any impression on you and your family when you heard about it? Do you remember? We're going back now.
Yes, we heard it, of course, and we knew about it. I think it hardened resistance amongst the people to some extent, because unconditional surrender is a pretty grim prospect. And although we couldn't do anything about it one way or another, and it didn't make any difference to our life, really, because we had no influence on it. But I think it probably hardened some hearts, and possibly the forces, the military were affected by it. But this may well be, on my part, hindsight, that I've since read about it, actually. But the impression is that that hardened attitudes, really.
I think we now come to the FAU. Is this right, in 1946?
Yes, the first, a lot of them, came in December 45. I was in charge of, working for military government, of producing service for units, as it were. And I was working relatively independently there. And one day I was called into the CO's office, squadron leader Robertson, very Canadian, and he said, "We've got these people here. They're COs, and of course the best people are in the army, and they're not COs." I remember him. And they were the first representatives of No. 6 FAU reporting to the military government that they would be coming and forming a unit. And obviously military government was to give them facilities and access to things and a house. And I found their cook and their waiter and people for their house and their house. I only saw the two of them. And they went again, and then the unit came.
Who were the first two that you met? Can you remember their names?
Yes. It was Bruce Hunt and Basil Smith. They came. And they looked extraordinarily unmilitary, of course. Actually, just those two. Very friendly. I didn't have much to do with them. I found their domestic staff. And I also found them interpreters. They had to have somebody for the office, and that was a friend of mine and my sister. Nepotism, absolutely right, but I knew they could speak English and would be reliable. Anyway, there went. And then the unit in full strength, or in greater strength, came after Christmas and settled in. And that, of course, is how I stayed in contact with them, because my sister worked for them and she reported progress on them.
Yes, we're talking about the FAU, aren't we?
Yes, well, the FAU settled in, and I obviously got into personal touch with them because my sister worked there. One was invited to odd functions, one met people, and they, of course, were one's own age, and if not one's own background, one's own education mainly, and so they were interested in all that went on. So one had a lot of talks with them, really, and chats on a purely sort of social friendly basis, without sex entering into it. Quite different, of course.
Were they very different from the other allied people you'd met?
Yes, I think they were, actually. Their outlook was different, their basic attitude was different, and although they were obviously very English in the best sense of the word, they were different from the military government people, really, particularly the officers. The the other banks in military government, for instance, gave us a Christmas party because they knew we were hungry and provided us with food in a very pleasant sort of way without you feeling awful because you were hungry and had to beg for food. Yes, the FAU, yes, they were different. One, there were far more points of contact there, and one became friends in lots of ways.
Did you understand, you know, you explained the warning or the remark made by the military man in your office. Did you yourself understand their pacifism, you know, and their CO status? Because you explained earlier on, it was very interesting, wasn't it, how you brought this up at your school once.
Mm-hmm. Well, I then learnt they were pacifists. I was I wasn't really amazed that they were allowed to be, because in Germany, of course, you couldn't be a pacifist. You would have been in some form of camp or shot or something. So this was possible. That was one wonderful thing. I didn't know anything about pacifism, really, except as a word, and that there were people who wouldn't take up arms. And we had, in fact, a lot of conversations about it, and I suppose I really only heard their way to pacifism from them. I think most of them were probably Christian pacifists rather than pacifists on general moral ground that they wouldn't kill. I think they wouldn't kill because they were Christians. That I believe at least that to be so. I learned about pacifism from them, I think. Yes, I could understand that. I've never found that difficult to understand. I myself wasn't put into that position. So I couldn't judge, nor did I have any friends who'd been put in that position. Nowadays, of course, in Germany, there are a lot of pacifists, young men who don't join the forces, and they have to do some social work instead of going into the forces.
How about the non-frat laws? You know, you were saying they were very friendly to you. Does this mean they completely disregarded them?
No, they were disbanded. By that time, they didn't exist anymore. Non-fraternisation laws, as far as I know, existed only for the first few months, if that. After that, they could talk to us. Of course, they did all the time, and they didn't have to have guns standing around. In fact, I remember the very amusing thing when you were in a car with one. I had to go out on an office, the officer. I had to sit in the back. I wasn't allowed to sit in the front. So I used to sit in the front, and we knew we'd come to a bridge where it'd be checked. I would move in the back, and then he'd left his gun in the back, so I had to sling him his gun to the front because I wasn't allowed to sit in the back with a gun. All these sort of things. So one thought of it is really rather funny. But of course, there were still laws against marriage. For instance, when I then met David in the FAU, which my sister came home one day and she said, "Oh, a new member has arrived, David Rudd. I think you'd like him." She spoke a prophetic word. I've forgotten what I was going to say.
I think we were getting on to marriage.
Yes. When I then met him, and then later on that year we got engaged to be married, you couldn't marry a German girl as yet. So when we were engaged, it was still against the law to get married. The engagement wasn't, but marriage wasn't possible yet. And that only, I think, came sometime November of 45, but I don't really quite know it was 46. I don't really know the exact date because it, as I said, it didn't affect me anymore. So we had the summer together, and I continued working for military government, and David went home in September to finish his studies. And I had been trying to get back to university during that time. which proved to be absolutely impossible. Heidelberg was the only non-destroyed town, and I had no priority at all. Men who'd been fighting and war widows and people who'd somehow suffered under Nazism all had preference, quite rightly so. So I couldn't get back to Heidelberg. And other universities weren't opened then. I got immatriculated in Würzburg, which was flat as far as I could see, but I couldn't live there. The university sort of existed in a hall, but I couldn't get accommodation there. So eventually I didn't go back to university in Germany because conditions were bad, and David and I decided that in fact we didn't want another 3 year or so separation, and it would have been all of that by the time I got in. So we decided to get married in 1947, and I started applying for permits about half a year before or longer. Enormously lengthy business, hundreds of forms of great length and permits and permission, and David had to propose inviting, and he obviously had to pay for the fare, and I had to have health certificates and certificates that I hadn't been in jail, and you name it, I had to have it.
What did he say when he proposed in writing?
Well, he made it very formal, and his father had to agree to it as well. He made it a very formal letter, which was really the simplest way, proposing marriage, and I would come to England and marry him. I had to send this letter in with my application, and I have never seen it since. So that was the official proposal.
What did your parents think of this? You know, first of all, your parents, that you were going to marry an Englishman.
Oh, they didn't mind at all. They were pleased. They liked David. They had met him. On getting engaged, my mother put the question, which I told her, I've got engaged to be married, and she said, which one is it? So this is a standing joke in the family. No, they were all in favour, and obviously they were sad I would go so far away, and at the time it seemed a long way because you couldn't visit at all. So that it was quite a big step to take, and I was very young, and I took the step in a sense simply because I was in love and not didn't think it all out. It's one does things like that when one is young.
Did you have any contact at all with your parents-in-law to be?
That was very nice. David went on leave after we got engaged. David went on leave home, and he told his parents, and they were very charming. And yeah, it was very lovely, really. And David's mother wrote me a letter, welcoming me into the family, and his father wrote, and various other relations, several close relations wrote. His brother was in the army in Italy, and he and his wife wrote. So I was very much accepted, and I always appreciated it very much. After all, they didn't know me. And there was their son, and David was still, after all, very young, actually coming home with a German bride, or engaged to a German girl, which was quite something to accept, I think. At the time, I felt, yes, well, why shouldn't they accept me, really? But it was lovely. I was delighted, and that was wonderful. My parents liked David, so there was no trouble at all. I suppose there was one family my hometown who cut me dead because I married an Englishman. Yes, I suppose attitudes hardened a bit. Life was very hard. Everybody was hungry and starving and down at heel, and they, in fact, had been rather nationalistic and Nazis as well, and they cut me dead, which didn't worry me one little bit. We always have this.
So when did you come to England?
I came in July 47. And it was a ghastly journey. It was a transport, officially arranged military government transport. I took about 3 days at least or so in camps behind barbed wire, nasty medicals again. It was a troop ship. We came over. Well, that was all right. But in fact, of course, most of the girls, there were a lot of other German girls, had married, of course, people in the army. And they weren't particularly sociable of a high caliber. It was all a bit difficult. English officers didn't marry German girls much, if at all. I suppose they were more discouraged. But the troops did, and so on. Quite a lot of them, of course, already had babies, obviously. And it was all pretty demoralising, I thought, and a bit grim. It was the Empire holiday, and I came over to Tilbury. We came from Cuxhaven to Tilbury, quite a long trip, actually. Beautiful trip. I mean, just the North Sea was like a mill pond. I was lucky. And I was one of the few who could speak German and English, and the boat was full. There were some troops. There were a lot of Lithuanians and people, Baltic people, and about 100 German girls. And I remember being asked to, in the end, clear the ship, make the announcements in German and English to get everybody off the boat, because there wasn't anybody else, I suppose. And there I was at Tilbury. I remember the Thames estuary. All right, not very thrilling. And we landed at Tilbury, and David was late. Actually, what was rather horrible was on landing, they had German prisoners of war to carry our luggage, which was awful, because obviously they felt it was pretty, because they obviously felt that was rather awful, that they were still prisoners and they're of war in this country, and German girls came to marry Englishmen. But they tended to pick out the luggage of girls of their hometown, and in the hope of having some news of their family. And the one who carried mine asked me this, that, and the other, and we had quite a friendly chat. But I remember feeling a bit awkward about it, really. But then David arrived, and it's all quite straightforward, and we drove home to his family. And the most important thing was to make a good impression on the dog. They had a big red setter, and if they all said, if Rusty likes you, all is well, and dogs tend to like me, so Rusty came and licked my face, and I felt thoroughly accepted.
How easy was it to settle in, though, to English life? Because this would be in 1947.
Yes.
Just 2 years after the war.
That's right. It was very soon. It wasn't easy. Things were all very difficult, and one had quite an enormous complex about German, being German. I had that for years. I don't think it was necessarily very noticeable, but one had sort of come to think that everything German was bad, almost, or a lot of things, so many things really had been, that I felt that quite strongly when I wanted to explain something we did different, I would always think, oh, well, perhaps it's a bad way of doing it. So it was quite a complex. I had a very friendly reception, lovely family, so there was no problems. And we lived at Guildford then, which was rather nice. But it wasn't easy. David had to start his apprenticeship and his graduate apprenticeship and at Rugby, and it was all difficult to get accommodation. It was very difficult in this country. So in fact, after we were married and David went to Rugby, I spent a term at Woodbrook in Birmingham, which was very delightful, lovely set of people there, of course, very interesting and wonderful, and I studied the term of international relations. But again, it wasn't like starting married life, of course. We were in two different places. My sister came. She was invited by the Quaker. And actually, my mother came. She was invited by the Women's League for Peace and Freedom, of which she'd been a member before 1933, and that had, of course, stopped during Hitler's time, and then it was restarted again in 1945 or 1947, and she had contact with the English branch, and so she was invited, so I saw her. We lived in various places. I had never housekept at all, and that was tricky. We had very little money. David was doing his apprenticeship, and everything was different, weights and measurements and cooking and food and rationing and points. It was difficult, really. I thought so. But one is young and one wanted to fit in. That was really the main thing, and wanted to learn. And so I think my English improved very rapidly. And I started to read English books with ease. Up to then, I'd only read about one or two books, and it'd been a bit of a struggle, obviously, take me ages. And suddenly I could just read a book, and of course the whole world of English literature opened up, which was wonderful. I sort of read through whole authors, as it were, and I enjoyed that. One made friends, and I found that if they just met me and had no prejudice, they were just as friendly to me as anybody else. If they knew beforehand I was German, there were one or two people who were then rather holding back, and it took some time to overcome that. Usually the people who'd hardly noticed the war, the ones who really suffered, actually were much friendlier. I found that all along. I found that amongst Jewish people. I came up against one man who just, a Jew I worked for, who'd just been in this country, and he hadn't, in a sense, suffered personally. And he was pretty nasty. But I met a lot of Jews I became quite friends with, the ones who really had been through the mill, and they didn't think anything of it, which was always rather nice. Well, we lived in various towns, in Rugby, and then we lived a year and a bit in Stafford.